I'll come up here, then I'll feel that I'm really on. Do I need a translator? Okay, all good. Well, Charlie can do it as well. Okay. I understand there's some people here from New Zealand as well. Welcome if you're here from New Zealand. And I've got a message for you. Your pastor wants you back in New Zealand, if that's you. Look, it's a great privilege to be here. I'm really enjoying being in North America. Never been to the US, never been to Canada before. Yesterday we went to a place that's hard to pronounce, but really quite beautiful. Gananoque, did I do it right? A Thousand Islands. We went on a cruise looking around. I'm not a big one on cruises, but hey, this was only 2.5 hours, so I could cope with that. Beautiful. Islands where, well, really you only need an island this big to build a house this big. So I think if I came back, I'd look to live on one of those islands, I reckon. I want to talk with you this morning about the importance of having a midlife crisis. You familiar with that idea over here in Canada, a midlife crisis? They're pretty common in Australia. People go through a midlife crisis. Sometimes it means you're bored and you need a change. Sadly, sometimes the boredom and the change take place in marriages. So you get a marriage that's kind of been kind of plodding along for a while. The husband or the wife start to drift, start to think things could be better. And sadly, often there's a breakdown in the marriage, a crisis that affects the couple, it affects the children, it affects other people. And it's a sad occasion. Other times, and a friend of mine suggests that rather than changing your wife, you should change your car. There's a lot less collateral damage in doing that. And one friend of mine, I'm sure he's going through a midlife crisis at the moment because he has just purchased himself a 1969 light blue Mustang convertible in Australia. 50 years, apparently, anniversary this year of that particular car. Why would you do that? Why is a midlife crisis such an issue for us? And I think it's this, that we reach a period in our life when we think there is less time left than what we've had already, and we're dissatisfied with what we have done. And so we look to fill our lives with other things, whether it's relationships or whether it's possessions, whether it's experiences, whether it's moving into a new career, something that we feel will fill our lives with purpose. We'll now be satisfied. We'll now get something that we really want, that we feel will really fill us as people. But I want to suggest to you that a midlife crisis can be a very important thing. And whether you're 42 years of age or 52 years of age, that's perhaps in the middle there, or whether you're only 22 years of age, or maybe you're 82 years of age, it's not too late, and it's still very important to have such a crisis. If the crisis causes you to stop and to think about what life is all about. In particular, what your life is all about. You see, the people that I mix with just kind of cruise through life. We live one day to the next without thinking terribly much about big issues, about major concerns. I live in a town that has been shaped by a culture of surfing. And it doesn't matter whether you're a little child going along on Sunday mornings when there's almost 1,000 of them on the beach, or whether you're an old salt, they call them, you're in your 60s, your 70s, even your 80s, and you're on your longboard every morning, and if you're not on your longboard, you're standing there on the boardwalk or the sand commentating on those who are surfing, it's not too late to have a crisis. And maybe you, here this morning, need to have a midlife crisis. Now, it's impossible to work out when midlife is, because none of us know the days that are numbered for us. I'd hazard a guess, though, that if you're 82, you've probably passed it. But don't feel that you've missed out. You can still have this crisis. If this crisis causes you to stop and to think about what life is all about. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about my midlife crisis. I'm 49 years of age. Well, I was. I'm in Canberra, and I'm looking to move to Darwin. I'm feeling that I'm in the midst of a crisis. Here, I've lived all of my life. I've raised my family. I spent a lot of my childhood years as well in the city of Canberra. We feel that there is a legacy in some ways in terms of the church and relationships, and we have a home. But we feel that we should move and make a change. But isn't it interesting? In God's purposes, he had a change prepared, but it wasn't the one that I thought. And that change was really quite dramatic. I was admitted to the hospital on the Friday. It was the Friday before my wedding anniversary. They let me out again on the Saturday. I can't remember to this day what I had planned for my wedding anniversary, but I know it didn't involve wearing a hospital band. On the Sunday, our, I think he was about 19-year-old son, was baptized. He'd made a profession of faith as a young adult. On the Sunday also, the man who was to replace me as the pastor of the church was voted in. On the Monday, I went back into the hospital and we had surgery. The reason that I'd been breathless and that I'd been struggling as I walked up hills, that I'd been aching and my left side had gone numb, was being caused by 3 litres of fluid around my left lung. For the primary cancer had ruptured. It had spread into the pleural cavity. It had spread into the lymph system. I was being diagnosed not early, where sometimes there's the hope of surgery that might take it away, but late. Estimation was that the cancer had been growing inside me for 5 years. It had spread to parts of the body, it had ruptured, and it had created new areas of cancer, so there was no option of surgery. There was no option of radiation treatment that might get rid of it. In fact, my oncologist told me that there was no option of a cure. We can't get rid of this type of cancer, he said. How do you know? Well, we just haven't. It's not one that we get rid of. And I asked some very confronting, and my wife would say, dangerous questions. I asked the oncologist, so what's the prognosis? He said, well, you'll probably live 10 to 13 months. What do you mean, probably? He said, well, it's hard to say, but that's what we would expect with your cancer at your stage. He said, you'll probably see the next Christmas. It was December. 10 to 13 months. All of a sudden, my midlife crisis had become an end-of-life crisis. And what happened to me in hospital, I was not prepared for. I started to get worse because the operation that they did to remove the fluid and to take a biopsy and to work out how they would treat, if they could treat the cancer, actually caused further problems. My body went into shutdown. I was unable to process food. I was in constant pain. I was hallucinating from the drugs. I was fearful of what was happening. And I'd been in hospital before. I'd come off my push bike. I'd come off my motorbike. I'd been kicked playing football. There were all sorts of reasons why I'd been admitted to hospital before. And each time I had the anticipation of coming out feeling better. But now I'm being told there is no better. We don't know how long it'll take as you get worse, but there is no better. And so, physically, I'd say mentally, certainly emotionally, I'd not been one to cry, but I found myself just sobbing at times. Even in the months that followed, there were times when I'd be curled up in a ball, a fetal position, just sobbing, thinking that my life is trickling away. Well, after 2 weeks in the first hospital, I had got to the point where, in conversation with some of our closest friends who'd driven down from Sydney, that's about 3 hours, to visit me, my wife said to them, I don't know if he's coming home. I was going downhill rapidly. The surgeon who operated originally was very concerned that the hospital that he'd operated in, it was just the closest one to us, wasn't able to treat me any further. And so he effectively rescued me from the hospital. I was taken by ambulance to a more specialised hospital where they did the operation again. And then gradually, bit by bit, I started to improve. went in on the 2nd of December. I came out just before Christmas Eve on the 23rd. And as I came out a very different person. I thought that I was reasonably fit. I thought that I was reasonably active, and I was going to become more so when I went to Darwin. I was going to catch barramundi. I was going to shoot pigs. I was going to become, like a specimen of strength and activity. But I went into the hospital weighing 92 kilos, and I came out weighing 75. It's a pretty good weight loss strategy, but I don't recommend it. 17 kilos in almost as many days. And I could barely lift myself from the bed. My wife had rented a hospital bed and done up our study as a new bedroom. And I stayed in that bed for weeks, for months. It took a couple of months before I was physically strong enough to start chemotherapy. They put me on chemotherapy, hoping that it might just deal with some of the symptoms. It was never considered to be curative. I had four cycles every 3 weeks, and it was expensive, it was toxic. I actually remember on one occasion thinking, because it cost us $8,000 a visit, that I could have bought my children, and I had four of them, a car every time I went to hospital, instead of filling my veins with rat poison. But in God's kindness, that medical system, those drugs that had been worked out, started to do something. The first scans that I received showed that the cancer had continued to grow. But they thought it was worthwhile putting me on what they called a maintenance therapy. That is, they removed the most toxic of the drugs, they left me on the other two, and they dialed it back a little bit. And they said, come in each 3 weeks, and we'll continue to do that, and every 3 months we'll do a scan. 3 months after the first one, the tumour that they were tracking on my lung had actually shrunk to slightly smaller than the original. So they kept it going. And then the next scan showed that it had actually shrunk to about the size of a golf ball. So they kept it going every 3 weeks. And it was pretty intense. I'd go into the hospital on a Monday. I'd sit in a chair, and it became harder rather than easier over these 4 years that I had chemo. I wouldn't feel too bad when I left, but within 24 hours I'd be bedridden for up to a week. And I would live my life in three weekly cycles. And I remember realising this on one occasion when a friend invited me to their wedding, and I said, I'll check my diary, and I said, I can't, I'm going to be sick that day. Seems like a weak excuse, doesn't it? Except that you know what you're going to be doing to yourself. Well, the next scan, 3 months later, showed that the golf ball had shrunk to a marble. And then the next one had shrunk to a pea. And then I remember a friend who actually walked from the 89th parallel down in Antarctica to the South Pole for the anniversary of the discovery of the South Pole, had been praying for me at the South Pole. Now, I don't know whether that's, like a special prayer if you get prayed for at the South Pole. But I've got photos of him saying, one for Macca, right? But he said to me, Macca, we're praying for a mustard seed next time. And on the 31st of May, the following year, my wife, and I haven't told you this, she's actually a doctor, so it was a great help to me because I didn't have to wait the weeks for the scan results. She was on the fax, and so she'd get it that day usually. And she came in, and I was sitting on the bed, and she gave this to me, and she said, read it. And I started to read this document. It was blah, 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 blah. I couldn't understand any of the medical jargon. Got to the end. The last sentence said, no evidence of. And I didn't know what the word meant. Can't even remember what it was. It wasn't tumour. It wasn't cancer. It wasn't metastasis. I've forgotten what it was. I should learn this. But I said, what does that mean? And she said, look it up. So I went to Google and I looked it up and it said, tumour or cancer. I said, what do you mean? Said it's saying there is no evidence of cancer. Now this was 19 months into the treatment. 19 months, and now I'm being told that the maintenance therapy did more than maintain it. It actually worked to attack the cancer and a lot of other things, I can tell you. But it left me now with a glimmer of hope. Just a glimmer. Because as soon as I went back to the oncologist, I said, does this mean that I'm now in remission, that I'm now cured? He said, no. Just means that the only way we can test to see this is via a CT scan, and we can't see anything on the scan. It's still there, he said. It's still there. And you've got to keep fighting it. For how long? Well, as long as you live. Chemotherapy every 3 weeks for as long as you live. Well, I continued for another 2 years. It became very difficult, both physically and mentally, to face the treatment. And so, with some support from others and after consultation with my wife, especially in the family, we made a decision to stop treatment. And I'm still here today, 3 years later. But you know what? When I was diagnosed and was told that I had a terminal illness, I saw that as a major midlife, if not end-of-life crisis. Because it felt like someone was saying to me, you have a terminal illness, therefore you have no hope. And I've since met with and mixed with and engaged online with so many people who have even the same subtype of cancer as me, whose greatest hope is that they will stay alive long enough for them to discover the cure. And I think I was a slow learner, because it wasn't for about 6 months that I realized that my diagnosis of terminal lung cancer wasn't new. I already had a terminal illness. And I know enough to say that every single one of you in this room do as well. It's actually called life. And we are given life for a time. Only for a time. Does that mean that God, when he made this world, made a drastic mistake, giving people only a short period of life to end in misery? No. The Bible tells us that death came into the world as a result of our sin. And that my terminal illness, my real terminal illness, wasn't the cancer. It was the sin. And even if the drugs took away the cancer, I would still be left without hope unless there was something that could deal with the sin. And you'd think, wouldn't you, that a Christian pastor would know that. That I'd be confident in these things. But I tell you what, when your body is being devastated through disease and through treatment, when your mind is playing tricks on you through drugs and through depression, when nobody is actually looking to give you any hope of the life that you were dreaming of, it's very easy to question those things that you believe. For me, that was the core of my midlife crisis. And I want to encourage you to have that crisis. I don't know whether you've been Christian for decades, or whether you're still working out what you believe about these things. Maybe you're a new believer. I want to push you to have the crisis that asks the question, is there a reason for hope? Not just for this life. We all have hopes for this life. But is there a reason for hope for all eternity? And I want to say to you, there is. And I was pushed to go back and to look at the scriptures again. People would open the Bible with me sometimes at my bedside, and we would read over things sometimes the very things that had led me to become a Christian in the first place. And I want to take you to one particular passage. And that passage is in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And you might want to look it up if you've got the Pew Bibles there. You can find it on page 141. Yeah, I remembered that. If not, just listen as I read it. I want to read from 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and from verse 1. I'm not reading from the Pew Bible. This is the New International Version. Now, brothers and sisters, I want to remind you of the gospel that I preached to you, which you've received and on which you have taken your stand. By this gospel you are saved if you hold firmly to the word that I preached to you. Otherwise you have believed in vain. Now hear this. For what I received I passed on to you as of first importance. You can almost imagine if the Apostle Paul was on his deathbed and he had the opportunity to say one thing to you, this is what he would have to say. This is of number one, first importance. Forget everything else you've ever heard. Listen to this. Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures. That is, it was promised that one who would be the Christ, another word for the King, God's King, would die for our sins according to the Scriptures. We've just been through Easter. And Christians have this bizarre habit of calling the day where we remember the death of Jesus Good Friday. What are we, twisted? No, we're realists. Because we know that without the death of Jesus, there would be no hope for us because of our sin. We stand guilty before God because of our sin. That is, we fail to put God number one. We put ourselves before God. We live for ourselves rather than our Creator. That is sin. And God judges that sin. But the beauty of Good Friday is that he takes the judgment upon himself in Jesus. Christ died for our sin according to the Scriptures. That was always God's plan. There is always hope because of Good Friday. He goes on to say that he was buried. Why does he say that? Well, literally, there's evidence for the fact that he was dead, because you don't bury living people. So there's evidence in his burial. There's prediction in the Scriptures. There's the actuality on the cross. And we see the meaning to deal with sin. And then listen. And that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. Again, this was promised. And that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. So you've got the promise of the resurrection. You've got the evidence of the resurrection. And you've got the meaning of the resurrection. Here now is Christ the Lord. Now, one of the things that I struggled with as a new Christian was the fact that I'd grown up in a Christian family, and I wondered when I left home whether I'd just kind of been indoctrinated, whether I'd accepted all of this because it was the environment that I was in. And I remember as a first-year university student living away from home, going back and looking for evidence for the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Some of you may have looked at a book that I looked at called More Than a Carpenter by Josh McDowell, looking at the Scriptures. Some of you may be unconvinced by a book that fat and have read the big one called Evidence That Demands a Verdict, or unconvinced and read the follow-up, More Evidence That Demands a Verdict. The point is there is evidence, and it's good evidence. It's both in the Bible and it's outside the Bible. It's the evidence of a transformed group of people. And that's what he talks about here. Listen to this. He appeared to Cephas, that is to Peter. Peter was probably the spokesman for his followers. If anyone knew Jesus, it was Peter, it was Cephas. And he didn't start well, did he? You remember the accounts on that night when Jesus was betrayed? Well, Peter betrayed Jesus three times himself. And yet, isn't it amazing that in the grace of God, he goes on to write two letters in the New Testament? God shows him mercy. He's persuaded that Jesus is alive. Then he appeared to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. See, some people say to me from time to time, I don't really mind whether Jesus lived or didn't live. I don't really mind whether he was crucified or not. I don't really mind whether he was raised from the dead physically, whether it was real. I just like to believe this stuff. And I think, more for you. The Apostle Paul himself in this chapter goes on to say, if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, then I'm a liar. and I'm to be pitied because I'm basing my life on a lie. And I may as well give up on all of this and go and eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow there is no hope of resurrection if, in fact, Jesus wasn't resurrected. Here he's telling us that it does matter. Christian faith is grounded in history. It's not just a set of ideas. It's not just a philosophy or another religion. It's based on history. And when it says that Jesus appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, what we're dealing with there are witnesses who could be cross-examined. This occurs within 20 years of the events being described, Jesus' death and resurrection. And within that period of time, some of those 500 have died, but there's plenty around that you could interview. We could bring them into a courtroom and we could ask them one by one, without reference to each other, what did you see? What did you hear? Was he alive? I remember back in year 12 at school, there were a group of four people who were driving to a place outside of Canberra, four students from our high school. They were going to a caving excursion, and it was a dirt road, a windy road on a steep hill, and the car that one of them was driving slipped off the road and it rolled down to the bottom. Two of those teenagers were killed, and the other two fairly seriously injured. Now, I knew both of them. And I remembered a short time later being in the shopping centre, and I could swear that I saw one of them. And I went up, and no, it wasn't them. And of course it wasn't them. You see, some might say, well, they were mistaken. They didn't really see Jesus. But you can interview these people. Peter, the 12, the 500. He goes on after this. Then he appeared to James. I think that means his brother. Not just his disciple, but the one born of his mother. He ought to know. You don't always get it right with other people, but you should know your own family, shouldn't you? And then he says, then he appeared to James and then to all the apostles, and last of all he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born. The Apostle Paul's experience of Jesus was a little later. He was walking to Damascus, and light shines, and he hears a voice saying, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? The Apostle Paul, who wrote this, was at the time an enemy of Christians. He believed that what was being taught about Jesus was a fabrication and a lie. But on that road to Damascus, he met the resurrected Jesus, and it changed his life. Saul became Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles. What would persuade Paul to flip? What would persuade Peter and James and the 12 and the other apostles to lose their lives rather than deny the resurrection of Jesus? Because, friends, that's what's happened. I take it. It's the truth of Jesus dying for our sins and being raised to life. I want to encourage you, if you're unsure about these things, if you've drifted from these things, if you know that you need to find out more about these things, to make it a crisis. And a crisis is something that matters. Make it a crisis. Dig into it. Find out about it. Get answers. Make your response. Don't drift through life. If the death and the resurrection of Jesus are not something that you would say is of first importance, you need a good crisis. You really do. And I encourage you to have it. There are reasons, and those reasons are grounded in the Scriptures. I thank God that even as a Christian pastor, He gave me pause to think and to reevaluate what I believed. He pushed me to find a hope beyond cure, a hope for all eternity through the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Thank you, God.